So I was given the rather broad topic to talk about observations of supernova light curves. And if you read AstroPH, you notice there's probably observations of supernova light curves appearing every day. So I wanted to focus this a little bit, in particular for the audience here, people drawing from massive stars, and to motivate some of the talks later this week, which are about the detailed theoretical modeling of the light curves. And so the way I thought I would focus it is to talk about the things that we can learn from large samples that we're going to get from current and ongoing surveys, and try and stress that while it's great and I encourage the very detailed modeling of individual objects to match the observations, when you start looking at samples of objects, it becomes a bit harder to understand whether or not you're actually matching the entire population. And so I'm drawing on results from a large number of groups. Since I'm the only supernova observer here, I was a good boy. I cited all the other groups as well, but of course there's a bias towards things that I am either directly familiar with, because I participated in them, or that I remember that they had a good figure. So this is the light curve of a canonical type 2 supernova. As viewed from the observers, you have a bunch of different filters. And if you notice, in particular, in the red part of the optical, you have what is known as the famous plateau. It lasts for about 100 days, and then connects and drops off like that. But notice, first of all, this is a strong functional wavelength going from U to B to V to R to I. The slope of this changes dramatically. But as you, if you fit the bolometric properties here, you fit the temperature and the evolution, you find that radius increases with time, temperature drops with time, and temperature asymptotes to a value around 5,000 Kelvin. And that's an interesting number because it approaches the hydrogen recombination temperature, hydrogen ionization temperature. And if you get well-sampled data for a type 2 hydrogen-rich supernova, it can look something like this. This is a V-band of some random supernova. There's kind of three epochs here. There's an initial thing, there's the long plateau, and then there's the final radioactive decay tail. So there's actually a fourth epoch, which we don't have any data on here, which is the initial shock breakout up here. But these three epochs have been understood for many years based on explosion models of red supergiant stars. And I pulled this figure from an older paper by Ron Eastman and collaborators just to show that the basic idea and basic principle has been known for a long time in basic scaling. So initially, in the first 10 to 20 days after explosion, you have this initial portion of the light curve, which can vary quite a lot. And that initial portion of the light curve is powered by the fact that you had a shock go through the supernova, it heated up the envelope, it's now cooling down. And the details of this initial part of the light curve depends on the supernova radius, most sensitively, but also the shock energy and so forth. And to get these characteristic sort of luminosities, you require a radius that's a few times 10 to 13 centimeters or so, some variation, and that's consistent with red supergiant. Step two is the kind of plateauish looking thing. So this is a theorist light curve, which means it's bolometric. If you saw the observational light curves, you saw that as you went from the blue, it was steeply declining, to the red, it was flatter. In fact, in I-band, they frequently increase over time. And this represents the bolometric redistribution of flux as the temperature drops. But more or less, you have a 100-day-ish portion of the light curve where the luminosity is powered by hydrogen recombination. And for characteristic scalings, to get a 100-day-ish plateau, you need about 10 solar masses of hydrogen. So this is worth stepping through in some detail, because I'm going to be talking about our observations of plateaus in just a bit. So there's a lot of different semi-analytic scalings for these that you can look up, dating back at least Arnett in 1980. There's a bunch of different ones that are cited in the literature. I chose these from Kazin Woosley's 2009. Paper to show you. And these are based on diffusion timescale arguments that you have some envelope that's recombining at some TI, some ionization temperature of hydrogen. So as the envelope recombines, hydrogen goes from ionized to not, and there's a very steep increase in the opacity because of this ionization change. And so that means the photosphere is very closely coupled to where this ionization happens. There's some opacity scaling, there's dependence on the explosion parameters and properties of the star. So this derivation, you get slightly different exponents depending on exactly what you assume. But this exponent assumes that you have radio diffusion recombination of the shock deposited energy at some characteristic ionization temperature. So we have kind of two observables and kind of five or six parameters across here. You can add additional parameters from velocity or so forth, but it's not quite as bad as it looks. So first of all, you have an ionization temperature, which represents sort of the temperature at which hydrogen is ionized at these conditions.
And that, so you have a luminosity and a time, but multiply those, you get an energy. Mm-hmm. And that energy doesn't scale like the recombination energy. So you said this was powered by recombination. Is it powered or is it limited by recombination?
Well, it's adiabatically degraded, which is...
But it's the escape of energy that's stored in the hydrogen, right?
So yes.
If you look at the Kaysen and Ramirez Ruiz paper, which looks at exactly recombination powering only, you get different plateaus. So if you look at the Woosley and Kaysen and Ruiz paper, right, then it's not only powered by recombination energy, there's stored energy in the envelope that's expanding.
Yes, of course. Yes, it's not just purely recombination, yes. Yes, so you have this, which should be pretty constant from object to object. You have an opacity, which it's all hydrogen-rich material at kind of similar densities, should be pretty similar. And so now you're down to just three parameters and two observables here. And if you look at this, well, you can see that some of these dependencies are pretty weak. So the length of the duration here, it's only weakly dependent on R0 and energy. And it's more strongly dependent on the mass of the ejecta. So this is simple. It's a diffusion argument. Time scale goes like the square root of the amount of stuff. Luminosity, however, it depends much more strongly on the energy and less strongly on the mass of the ejecta. Now, these are just based on the previously deposited energy diffusing outward at some recombination temperature. But an additional effect, which was noted as far back as Eastman, was that the nickel produced in the explosion has an effect on the shape of the plateau. So these three different models here correspond to three different models with different nickel masses. And you can see that just by adding a reasonable amount of nickel to the explosion, you increase the length of the plateau by 20 to 30%. So any realistic model has to take that into account. And then finally, the light curve settles on the radioactive decay tail, where it's being powered by cobalt decay. And of course, there's many possible higher order effects about exactly how that nickel is mixed outward or not into the envelope. But the point is, at the late times, you reach this asymptotic decay slope, which hopefully closely matches the cobalt deposition rate. And I'll show you it doesn't exactly. So observationally, what do we see? And this is something that has changed pretty dramatically, I would say, in the last 5 years, now that we're starting to get large samples from surveys. So the lore in this field for a while was that you had what were known as type 2 plateaus and type 2 linears. And this goes back to a definition of Barbon in the 1970s, where he looked at the blue light curves of type 2 supernovae, and he said, well, it looked at the decline rates and said, we have two different types. We have the plateau and then a linear decline. So these were split into type 2P, plateau, and L for linear. And if you look at some subsamples in the literature going up into this decade, you can see some evidence for this. So this is from a paper by Ayer Akavi and the Caltech Core Collapse Project. If you take a bunch of R-band light curves of type 2 supernovae, you scale them to the peak to match, there's kind of three classes here. First, you have the typical stereotypical plateaus, which are kind of constant in the R-band for 100-ish days. Over here, you have a couple objects which decline very quickly, and all of those display helium lines that are indicative of being a type 2b. And so in the type 2bs that have been extensively modeled, the hydrogen masses are something like a tenth of a solar mass. So you can imagine this is sort of a star with a 10 or 15 solar mass hydrogen envelope. This is one with a 0.1 solar mass envelope. In the middle, you have a class called the type 2Ls. So it seemed pretty simple. And you see this in other samples as well. This is from the Lick Observatory Supernova Search. You scale everything to peak. There's a pretty bimodal distribution of the Klein rates, type 2Ps versus type 2Ls. And so there's a whole lot of related, similar criteria used in the literature that all kind of more or less split things the same way. They aren't exactly the same. And so the question is, what's setting the 2Ls apart from the 2Ps?
Your plot suggests that there's similar numbers of 2Ls as 2Ps.
No. Yeah. So that's one fact. So one thing that's sort of suppressed here is the relative numbers. And it depends on which sample you look at because they are not all complete. In the Lick sample, which is where this came from, in our distance-limited sample, we said it was about 10 to 20% of type 2s or type 2 apples by this classification. So there's two classes of explanations here for what's going on to separate the plateau from the linear. One is, well, this is a thick envelope. This is a very thin envelope. So let's strip off that envelope and have some intermediate hydrogen envelope, possibly due to a greater progenitor mass for these objects as opposed to these objects. Other way to look at it is maybe there is an additional early power source here that represents circumstellar interaction. We'll come back to that. But these may be related or may be aspects of the same thing. So what has changed in the past few years is that we've started to get very large samples of supernova light curves coming out of surveys. And so here are two different surveys selecting objects very differently. On the right is the Carnegie Supernova Project and a collection of V-band light curves from Manderson et al. You notice, okay, so this is the unnormalized version. There's quite a spread in the plateaus, plateau luminosities. We knew that already. But you can also see in here these lines, you know, there's quite a wide range in plateau durations, light curve shapes, and so forth. In fact, if you do the normalized test, normalize everything to peak, these lines here, the color lines, are some famous type 2 plateau supernovae. Here's type 2Bs, and there's a continuous spray throughout the entire range of parameter space.
It's kind of hard to tell. There could be different densities of black pixels.
Next slide. Yes.
The main point is just a mess.
But it doesn't look bimodal anymore.
I don't know if you had a grayscale, that should have just looked like
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I'll go back to another slide, but so they parameterize the light curve as kind of piecewise. And on the plateau, the blue thing here, was their measurement of the decline rate, magnitudes per 100 days. You have a very broad distribution with no obvious bimodality. And similarly, this is what we found in PanSTARRS, where we had five-band photometry. I'm just showing you the R and I light curves. Again, all the points are connected, and you just see a continuous spray of points over the entire.
Can we go back to the previous slide to see the ideal? There we go. So at 100 days, it really would, according to the right plot, have divided into three peaks.
Yeah, so a lot of the measurements used to discuss type 2 supernovae are based on measurements at 50 days. So luminosity at 50 days, velocity at 50 days, the decline at 50 days. And part of the reason is because that's kind of halfway through the plateau for most objects, and so you aren't very sensitive to edge effects. Another is that things aren't usually changing very much at that point. And so you'll see those definitions within 50 days a lot here. And so, yeah, and so here, this is the R and I band light curves from PanSTARRS that I showed on the previous plot, where this is also a decline rate parameter in somewhat different units, flux units. But you can see the distribution in these giant samples of now we're talking 75 to 80 objects, it doesn't look bimodal at all. There seems to be a continuous distribution. And under various statistical tests, there's no evidence for bimodality here.
How many supernova are being sold?
75 to 80-ish. So actually, the PanSTAR sample started with 120-ish, but various data quality cuts take you down.
Can you say you're measuring things at 50 days?
This is a slope measured like here. And so they're parameterized slightly differently. Over here, the slope was magnitude per 100 days on S2. So in fact, the way they parameterized it, if we go back here, they have three slopes, S1, S2, S3.
So with your big sample, do you have enough data to tell whether there's a cutoff in the plateau length? Do you see plateau is less than 80 days, 70 days?
Is it still a plateau when it's going down
sharply?
Yeah, okay. So what's the plateau?
Okay.
So anticipating future slides, the answer is for things that have a piecewise plateau, this is found using a Bayesian light curve model because of fragmentary data and so forth. But we find things with plateaus as short as kind of 60 days and as long as maybe 120.
So how are you doing the duration?
So this varies. So this varies from study to study. And so that's one of the reasons why things in the literature, it's hard to reconcile them, is because they use different durations. So some of the durations you will see are basically this optical duration. Some are basically this, just the plateau fitting this separately. And where you draw this endpoint here, some people go here before it drops, some people go partway down the plateau.
Do you actually look at it, or you say when it drops below a certain amount of flux from peak or from start of the plateau? Like how would I say, is that by eye draw the line, or is it the flux that now drops?
So I would say the different studies have approached this problem differently and come up with similar-ish answers to that question. So I can't remember exactly how Anderson et al. Did this, whether he just did it by eye and said, well, that's pretty obvious, so.
The PanSTAR definition is sort of a midpoint between where you leave here and you arrive at the table.
Yeah, so that's the T-mid that Hamui defined, and that's...
Anderson's doing something similar, as I remember.
Yeah, and we were doing instead this piecewise Bayesian thing where we have priors on everything based on the well-sampled light curves, because one of the issues is that as your sample grows bigger, the data quality tends to go down on average. But yes, these are all interesting questions. So, no statistical evidence for bimodality. Okay, well, maybe there's some continuous distribution, but still, it's kind of a puzzle. So, this is gray is the Anderson et al. V-band decline rates in terms of magnitudes per 50 days on that plateau. It's a very broad distribution, as we just saw. These dark points are from the well-observed objects from the Lick Observatory supernova search, where they were split into 2P and 2L based on a simple R-band cut. So of course, they don't overlap because it was based on R-band decline rate. But it's very hard to imagine how you draw from this and end up with that. So the CSP light curves here were drawn from a heterogeneous, well, it's a single supernova survey for doing the follow-up, but heterogeneous source of discoveries. This is a uniform series of discoveries. The PanSTAR sample here was completely It was determined by the rolling nature of the survey, which means that the follow-up photometry was not separated from the discovery photometry. The only limitation was which objects we got spectra of. So it's very hard to understand how you reconcile this in the literature, except I will say my bias is now that we have samples of hundreds of objects instead of samples of 30 objects, you should believe the samples of hundreds of objects. There's definitely observational biases in the properties here, but the fact that we're seeing everything in parameter space, I think, is an indication of the variety.
So we should throw out the 2P2L distinction? Say there's a whole spectrum.
Yeah, so I would agree that there's no useful single distinction there, but there's clearly a continuum of properties that correlate. And so if you take a definition that selects out objects at either end, they're clearly different from each other. So one of the most strongest correlations is that this decline rate parameter is related to the luminosity. So faster decline on the plateau, more 2L-ish light curves are more luminous. And this is seen in a number of different parameterizations and in different samples.
Are there color differences? Like, is it bluer or redder?
I believe at early times they are bluer. I'm not certain about that. I do know that there are also spectroscopic distinctions at the ends of the distribution as well. That at early times, the things that are 2L tend to have weaker amplitude emission absorption lines. And in the Fran paper, they showed that the oxygen lines, the 017774 absorption, for instance, is stronger in type 2Ls. So there's spectroscopic and photometric correlated differences along here, even if you can't draw a single line here. So, again, these are both brighter equals faster decline. So going back to this question about what is the distinction between 2Ls and 2Ps, I can say that maybe it's somewhat misleading to draw like this, where you've normalized everything to the peak. Because if you imagine taking this plateau light curve and adding some early time luminosity, it's going to look like that. So that's one of the solutions that has recently been proposed. Variations of this idea have existed, but this is a recent paper by Morozova, where they just took a 12 solar mass star, red supergiant, standard sort of parameters, and they added some very dense wind right next to the star. So we're talking a few tenths of a solar mass ejected within the last couple years before explosion. And if you do that, you can vary the mass and some other parameters, and you can get different amounts of early time luminosity, which raises the early time and then increases that slope. So this would have to be relatively optically thick material, relatively close. But it's possible that there's some relationship here to the idea that PTF in particular has been discovering this flash ionized material and very early spectra of type 2 supernovae. That there's material very close to even normal type 2P supernovae that's seen spectroscopically in the first couple days after explosion that then dissipates. So that material has to be at somewhat larger radius than this. Well, and has to be optically thin in order for the emission lines to get out. But it's possible that they're all aspects of the same sort of enhanced mass loss in the last several years before explosion.
Would your progenitor be dust enshrouded if this?
So that's a good question. And I would think that it would have to have some effect, but I don't know quantitatively whether that is allowed or not by the progenitor detections. So the direct detections of progenitors have mostly been type 2Ps. There's kind of one disputed type 2L slash 2P with a progenitor detection. And it came in at 18.
Any sign of an infrared echo?
Well, this would be very close by. So it would be run over by the supernova immediately.
Sorry, so what is 2M?
So two ends are the strong circumstellar interactors with the strong narrow hydrogen emission. And so my question mark here was saying, well, if a type 2P is a bare red supergiant, not exactly bare, they have nice winds, but a type 2L is you have some enhanced mass loss in the last few years before explosion, such that it has to break out through this early time dense wind. Maybe a 2N is if the shell of material is maybe a little bit further out, which allows the supernova to expand and hit it. So maybe there's some continuum here in the mass loss properties. And I just put this up here like this to contrast it with kind of the idea from the earlier plot where it was type 2P, 2L, 2B, some stripping. Now, the difference between stripping and mass loss may be in the eye of the beholder here.
Yeah, frankly, it's actually both. You have both effects. Sure. If you have like mass loss, I mean, they're only requiring even their deep, you know, most one is 0.83 solar masses, so it's not that much off the 12 solar mass star. But so it seems like that circumstellar medium is a bigger labor arm. To get that kind of slope, I would have had to move a lot of the hydrogen to get the same kind of labor arm. If I instead do the stripping model. That seems like a pretty big change for just losing 0.83 solar masses. Is that,
oh wait,
with the bottom one, it's 4.77 solar masses.
Yeah, and I can't remember what they're doing down here.
But the bottom one, the 4.77 ended up turning back into a
The problem is that the ones on the top panel still haven't changed the light curve at all beyond day 50 or so.
And it's because it has an external radius at a certain place, and so once supernovas expanded through that, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's nice.
So, kind of the big picture question I wanted to ask here by putting forward all these type 2 supernovae is, can we match the population as a whole and not just individual objects where you can, you know, tweak the placement of circumstellar material, or you can tweak the progenitor properties. These are all very valuable, but ideally we'd be able to match to the population as a whole and be able to infer properties about the stars that exploded. But here's kind of the most naive thing you can do. You took our, so this is again from the Sanders et al. Pan-star sample, took luminosity at 50 days, plateau duration, and the red points are the well-measured ones, and the gray points are less well-measured. And you know, there's some scatter plot here. These curves here represent models from Kazin and Woosley of red supergiant progenitors. And so look at particularly the blue and green points, the blue and green lines here. So because that's a 12 and a 15 solar mass star with zero nickel, and then a 12 and 15 solar mass star with half a solar mass of nickel, which is way more than usual. So with a moderate amount of nickel, the locus of points all is along here, where the controlling parameter is basically the explosion energy. The lower the explosion energy, the longer the plateau lasts, and the fainter it is. Yeah, just because it hasn't expanded as much. So here's the models, just red supergiant progenitors, and they're all like this, and the data go like that. And so if you were to then take one of these models and say this supernova here, you're like, okay, there's a model that goes through that data point. Like, okay, it's so many solar masses, such and such explosion energy.
Does it have a correct sort of shape in addition to having the right luminosity?
So we have, I don't know, actually. But the point I was going to make was just more general. If you have a point here, you can match your light curve. You may match your light curve very well, but can you actually believe any of those physical parameters if the majority of the objects are off the parameter space?
Majority of supernovas will be way less energetic basically that model predicts, because they all continue in the corner, which is less energetic.
Well, this is less mass.
Yeah, it's less mass, but it's also less energy, right?
Well, less energy would be down here, more energy would be up here. So at fixed ejecta mass, you have a band like this, and this is less energy, more energy. And so we chose the Kaysen-Woosley models because they made the grid available at the time. Other people are doing the same thing. Luc Desart has put out some grids of models. And you see kind of the same thing.
So the fact that things are sort of in the middle, it represents roughly count of 51 ergs. Is that the...
Yes, but of course everything is calibrated somehow.
if mapped onto those models, it's...
So yes, roughly. But factors of two are important here. So to put it another way, here, follow the solid histogram, because that's the one that matters, for the plateau duration. Kind of the simplest thing you can measure, plateau, it's pretty obvious in the data, usually you can see it, you can measure it. And it's basically 90 plus or minus 20 days, roughly. Model grids in which you are free to adjust the parameters of explosion energy, mass ejecta, have a wider range. And so not just Kaysen-Woosley, but Luc Desart's models as well. If you turn down the explosion energy to maybe 0.3 beta, 0.3 times 10 to 51 ergs, you get plateau light curves that last for 180 days. And no one's ever seen a supernova with a 180-day plateau. So this is not an unreasonably low explosion energy, one would think.
This basically shows that those models suck. That's the conclusion I draw. They have not changed enough parameters. Sorry, now I'll try to be quiet sooner.
So Luke's models were taking pistons and Mesa.
I know, Luke and I agree, they suck. But there's a lot more to be done. There are a lot more critically important parameters than the ones that we're looking
at. So the issue is the radius of the star is going to change it. We just saw this from the stellar medium. That's going to change it.
Yep.
So there's a lot of, and so the problem is, you can do it. You can do the parameter study.
All the mixing, overshoot the rotation.
How does the radius of the star?
So the rotation is not gonna, is not gonna change the light curve.
No, that's wrong. That's wrong.
If it changes the radius, so the issue is the thing that changes the light curve. It's nickel mass. It's radius. It's you can do some of the composition.
Go back to your scaling.
But the scaling is really those quantities. That's what's gonna change it.
Yeah, so R0 has only weak effect on...
And it's because it's entering through the entropy, which determines something about recombination, right?
Yes, it's because everything is scaled to some initial internal energy.
Yeah, so many... Okay.
And you add, certain stellar medium will also change it, which is not in those parameters because it wasn't studied. So you can add you have a set of parameters. They should be broader than what you're seeing. And then the question is, how does the population tell us something about this?
Yes, I agree. It's rare that the data are more narrowly confined than the theory. Usually there's parts of the theory you've left out.
So the other question is, so this is plateaus, is when the opacity is governing where the end of the photosphere is, right? And then certainly if you look in the pop-up paper, he scales out when you might not expect to plateau anymore, right? And the question is whether that governs the short end of the plateau. When you go to smaller and smaller masses, suddenly you transition into this region where recombination is not controlling the opacity, which controls where the photosphere is. So I think you get the classical explanation of the two L's rather than the
mm-hmm. Although one point I should mention, I don't have the plot here. Most of the classic 2Ls are followed relatively early times. And Stefano Valenti has a paper where he took a recent one, 2013 BY, I think, which is a steeply declining 2L, not a borderline case. He just followed it for hundreds of days, and at 100 some odd days, it fell off the plateau. So it clearly had some sort of plateau-like feature in its light curve, even though it was steeply declining.
Let me clarify my rude comment about those other models. They only suck in the sense that they're great for what they do, which is look at a certain small number of parameters. And the problem is, I'm just saying that small number of parameters is not enough. And so you can't, I'm making judgments, that's all. It's a very limited sample, changing a couple of parameters, and that's fine to get a first feeling for it, but I think there are a lot more things that are important.
Do you want to say what they are?
No. I spent the last year doing this with Mason, so that's what I'm still exploring, and I've got some stuff that will show up. But basically, there are a half a dozen to a dozen knobs in Mason that all are going to move the light curve around, some of which do big things, some of which do little things. The radius is certainly critical. Some of the standard ones are, of course, very, very critical, but there are a lot of other little things that come into this that, as well, that can also change the shape and scope and durations. We're just not looking at all of the parameters yet.
So the other thing to think about is if the two L's are no longer intermediate between the two B's and the two B's, what are the things that are? That's a lot of hydrogen mass difference.
Oh.
Well. So before, we used to go from 10 solar masses of envelope or 5 solar masses of envelope to 0.1, right? And we said, the two L's somehow fill in that gap. Right?
But if
they no longer do that anymore, which was the suggestion earlier, then there's a gap with nothing in it.
And so it may be that really is a gap with nothing in it.
That's one of the possible answers.
Of course, with binaries, you can do anything.
That's what I was going to say. In single star evolution, you can easily imagine how this happens, that the winds aren't strong enough at the maximum mass to lose.
On a population scale, that just can't be right.
Yeah, so there must be. But once you start invoking binaries, then you get everything.
Which is why winds, rotation, and other things are other parameters that play a part.
So, okay. We can't really explain the defining characteristic of type 2b supernovae, but let's move on to nickel production. So, the third part of the light curve. So, nickel is at least theoretically, the easiest thing to measure from the light curve. So for late time, you have a decay rate. It hopefully is at the cobalt rate. You're trapping the cobalt. You can just measure. You can scale everything to 87A, which is what empirically most people do. And you get a nickel estimate. So a couple points here. One, it's kind of hidden here, but this is the slope on the radioactive decay tail from the Anderson sample, which is V-band only, not bolometric. This is the cobalt decay rate. This is the distribution observed. And this is seen in other samples as well, that generally there's the cobalt, there's a spike at the cobalt decay rate indicating full trapping of gamma rays. There's a tail that faster decays. Whether that represents we're not capturing all the bolometric light or what, but there's a significant fraction of objects that are off the cobalt decay. But moving on, you can measure some sort of nickel mass. And one of the interesting things I find about the nickel mass estimates, so each sample is biased and so forth, but there's kind of two orders of magnitude range in the observed nickel masses. Yeah, from a few times 10 to the minus 3 to a few tenths.
But I don't understand the graph versus your just few tenths. It looks like there's a plot that has a zero in the log, which would be one solar mass in the nickel, or do I mean?
Yes. So these are noisy. I'll explain in just a second.
Okay.
So the maximum tends to be around 0.3.
Is this by scaling luminosities? What? I don't understand.
Is this actually the distribution in 0.1 solar mass? So from there, I see an answer that is 0.2 in the.
Yes. The so why is it? Why is there anything?
And I don't see anything less than minus 2.
So yes, that is totally a selection effect, in that if it has that little nickel, the decay tail was too faint for us to detect it, and so we couldn't actually constrain it. And so the faint ones aren't on this graph. So this is not the true nickel distribution. And hold the thought. Over on the right here is a recent paper by Tomas Mueller and Andre Pecha and Jose Prieto, who are attempting to measure what the actual nickel distribution is from hopefully a better controlled sample of nearby type 2 supernovae, where they're using Andre's models to factor out all the parameter dependencies, measure the nickel mass. And if I read the paper correctly, they threw out the object that had a nickel mass of 0.25 solar masses. But the rest of the objects here are in red, are the data. This is the differential, and this is the integrated. And the blue model here is taking some of the recent explosion models from Tugador, Sukolb, and doing an IMF and saying, well, what comes out in terms of the expected theoretical distribution of nickel masses? And so this is in linear space, so most of the objects are between, say, 0.01 and 0.1. But there are objects down in this bin here that go down below 10 MIS 2, for sure.
And for the poor non-observer, how are you observing the nickel mass, or how are you deriving the nickel mass from observations, I should say?
Yes, so basically, by getting the radioactive decay tail and scaling to 87A. So there are different ways of doing this in the literature, whether in a single band or approximating a UVAR metric.
The height of the tail or the slope of the tail?
The height of the tail.
The height is used to represent cobalt, but doesn't necessarily.
Yes, so it doesn't necessarily, it frequently does, frequently doesn't.
So you end up factor control for the fact that the slope changes a lot, you try to take the height of the tail early on the table?
Yeah, you kind of match up. So.
But if it's declining more rapidly than you expected it to, either you've got your expectations wrong or there just isn't as much cobalt there.
Or it's decaying rapidly because it's mixed out or something so that it's escaping.
Yeah. Because I'm a little confused. How do you, because doesn't it, it would seem like it depends on your escape, how you do the escape of these photons, the gamma rays.
Yeah, so the answer is you don't model that, and that's why you scaled the 87A. So that's empirically
but
the answer.
You're assuming that the 87A's escape rate is what also
fuels.
Okay. It just was a little bizarre on a supernova, so I'm surprised you didn't use it for your...
You use what you got.
Your thing.
Sorry, how is 87 days nickel mass determined?
So from the modeling and from actually measuring the...
You can do it, you're pretty sure on this mix.
Yeah. You're pretty sure, but it does show enhanced mixing outwards.
Yeah, it was one that you almost know had a, we see it. We see this explosion. It's going off in one direction. So it would be definitely have a different escape rate than say, Cass said.
Do we know the velocity scale that the nickel gets up to?
In these objects, no.
For
87A, yes.
What is that?
What's the velocity?
Was it 3,000 or 4,000 kilometers a second?
Yeah, it had a thing that was out like a 1,500, and then out to 3,000 to 4,000, it had some fast nickel, fast iron going out. So it looks
So there's a main thing, and then there's the tails, which could be the nickel bullets coming out, or some other clumpiness. But assuming that we've measured something here, we can also correlate it. And one of the strongest internal parameter correlations is that the nickel mass is correlated on an observational basis with the plateau luminosity. And this is a very nice correlation. Mario Amui first investigated this, I think. And given the scalings, in this case using the Popov scalings for the plateau, the luminosity on the plateau is most strongly affected by the explosion energy. And so then the nickel mass is correlated with the explosion energy.
Which is at least okay. That's reasonable. That's what you'd expect.
Yeah, and the best fit, so this is from Andre and Jose's model, and the best fit line here is within the error bars close to linear. The slope here, 1.13 in log space, 1.13. And so here you have your two orders of magnitude in nickel versus almost two orders of magnitude in explosion energy. So if you think about it, we add all those scalings, but the mass of the ejecta doesn't vary by more than a factor of two. The radius of the star, factor of two for red supergiants. The explosion energy is where you're getting your dynamic range for the observed properties. And this is the essence of how you use type 2Ps for doing distance determination. That the velocity, we haven't talked about spectra, but that velocity measured from iron lines on the plateau is also correlated with luminosity. And it's simply just saying that the expansion velocity is correlated with the kinetic energy. The luminosity is correlated with the kinetic energy. So you measure the expansion velocity, you get the energy, which tells you luminosity, and measure your plateau. And that's what's hidden in all these correlations. But that's Mario Hamui's standardizable candle method for getting distances to type 2 supernovae.
I'm surprised with your statement that you said that the radii of stars doesn't vary by more than a factor of two.
For red supergiants?
Yeah, because I think I couldn't even get two stellar Lucy codes to agree within a factor of two.
Okay, maybe a factor of two is an exaggeration, but the majority of objects appear to come from, maybe a factor of three in radius. So.
I'd actually agree with your vector two on this
one. Okay.
I'm on your side for once.
The issue is that then the codes sort of have a lot of work to do because, I mean, I did this, I asked this question to Stan, how well do you agree? He said factor two with Norbert Langer. And then I looked at their paper where they did a comparison and they didn't have a single giant that agreed within a factor of four.
So that's a systematic difference, not...
Well, it's a difference in their two simulations. It's not an observational fact.
Yes, it's a systematic difference between the two simulations, but within a given stellar evolution code, the range of supernova progenitors...
Yeah, but some supernova progenitors are known to blow up blue giants, right?
Yeah, but they will not be in this sample.
Yeah, no, these are... Yeah, we're talking about that. I'm talking about the red giant.
Yeah, we.
So you know for every single here where the progenitor was the red supergiant.
The blue supergiants have a different. The blue supergiants have a different light curve shape, and there are a handful of them known at the level of 2 to 5%, depending on exactly how generous you are in defining the boundary. So something like 2% or so are blue supergiant explosions, based on having light curves that rise like 87As did. So 87A didn't have a standard plateau, it was at lower luminosity, and it rose for 100 days.
So is there any concern, going back to the calibration against 87A and the nickel production, that it was not a member of the class that you were using?
Well, I was a good freak.
But I still understand. So if you take a 15 solar mass, red supergiant, and you take 20 solar mass, red supergiant, they can blow up at a very different radii.
Yeah.
And if one of them lost 5 solar masses of envelope, it would build the same amount of envelope at the time of blowing up, but they would have different radii because the cores are very different.
Yeah, so are you saying that your 10 solar mass star and your 20 solar mass star at the same radius?
No. Let me clarify a little bit more what I'm saying. Some of the knobs that I have to turn to try to get good matches to light curves and velocities include knobs that move the radius in and out. And I'm guessing that I have to move it by more than roughly a factor of two.
Oh, to match the light curves.
But initially, the
stellar models don't know shit. Excuse me, the stellar models don't know much about the details of what's going to be determining the radius of a red supergiant. That's really unclear, and it's going to be very sensitive. Some of the things like we've talked about earlier, like porosity, are like. The whole issues of the details of the fluffiness. So in the MESA models, I follow Luc Desart and change the radius by artificially going in and saying, okay, we're gonna change the mixing length alpha efficiency because we know that will change the radius. And we want to see what that, what a change in radius does. And we're just doing experiments here, guys. So we're going to change alpha as a way of getting the radius to change. So I crank up the efficiency, and that will drop the radius down. And the efficiency, the radius that comes out of some of those earlier formulas, like the pop-up formulas, will be down in the 500, 700 range often for the good matches. Whereas if you just let MESA run with the mixing length set at 1.8 or something like that, you get a very puffed up, much, much bigger, over 1,000 kind of arson radius. So it's the difference between 500 or 600 versus over 1,000 is all lost in our lack of knowledge of what the model should be in terms of a radius there. But it seems like to match the results here, you really need to have some that have a much lower radius, or if not most, with a lower radius that we would get just naively.
And in one of Luke's papers, he has some discussion about the fact that R star and R appropriate for the supernova aren't exactly the same radius, because you're talking about some shock decoupling at some radius versus, you know, some photosphere, which may be two different depths within star.
Yeah, I'm talking about the progenitor, yeah. The radius at the time of explosion as opposed to after breakout.
Yeah. But, okay, so the early time light curve is most sensitive to the supernova radius, or excuse me, the stellar radius. And so this is something of...
Now we're talking about the shock breakout radius.
Yeah. So this is something of a newer, subfield, because the observations haven't been good enough to really constrain this really well. But a lot of type 2s in historical literature, it's nothing, nothing, boom. But you can measure rise times, and in this paper by Gonzalez-Gaitan, using Sloan and SLS, they measure rise time in rest frame G-band. There's some distribution here. There's substantial errors on these points, so some of this width is errors, but it's typically around 7 days. And then they just took some standard scaling arguments for the radius of the progenitor and how it affects the rise of the supernova. And they get numbers out like 340 solar radii at the median, plus or minus a couple hundred solar radii on either side. So these are the cumulative distributions. So there's presumably a fair amount of assumptions going into this.
Something mixes together the actual early rise with whatever setting peak, right? Because it's the time from beginning to peak. So you'd like to have a measure that really just depends on the early light and not when you peak.
Yes. So I will. So those. Here's another way of looking at it. So these are the two Kepler type 2 supernovae that were caught on the rise with Kepler cadence photometry. And in that case, you can use these models for the explosion of a star, and you can fit the data very nicely, ignore this for a moment, with progenitor radii, 490, 280 solar radii. And you have kind of two numbers here, a rise time and a...
Stupid question, when you say the radius, so it's before it started to expand, or...
Right.
When you say that it determines the radii, it's before the curve started to flow.
Yes. It's where the shock breaks out, right?
Correct. It's a progenitor before it explodes.
Correct. Same thing.
Yeah, so you have a rise time and a peak magnitude, and they have different degeneracies on the radius versus energy, and so the two curves intersect at a point, and you get a radius and kinetic energy of 2 × 10^51 ergs, and radii that are reasonable for red supergiants.
Small,
which is the problem, going back to here, that if you look at red supergiants in the Milky Way and the Magellanic Cloud, sorry you can't see it, but it's kind of a cyan line and a green line, the medians, based on, these are from Emily Levesque's results, are around 500 or 600 solar radii, not the 300 to 400 that we measure. So it's a little bit on the small side, but...
Wait, the one Those were ASAMs? The invisible lines?
The invisible line here.
Based on doing models.
These are observations of actual red supergiants in the Milky Way and the Magellan Clouds, because this is a metallicity dependent.
Where those radii were determined by backing out numbers out of those.
I don't remember. You mean for the actual red supergiants?
The invisible lines.
Yeah, so these are the actual red supergiants. I can't remember how she measured it.
Right, okay.
This is your standard number you look up.
Yeah. So anybody remembers if you take a standard supergiant from the Milky Way and remove a few solar masses very quickly, what radius it will be? I mean, if they match very well with depleting the mass, but these supergiants which we observed in the Milky Way, they are well before their supernova explosion, otherwise we would have blown up, right? So if you will take and remove the mass and see what will be in 1 year, because that's your time scale, will they shrink?
They would expand.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. No. We know so little about the resistance. Yeah, anyway. I know. It's like,
if it has a high mass loss rate, you're not seeing the star radius, you're seeing the wind flows here. So I'm not sure what, you had a high mass loss rate.
I don't even know what the radius of a star is. It's not the photosphere.
So back to you.
Well, I mean, that's the only thing we can measure is the photosphere. We can measure radius.
So I can see why there'd be a metallicity dependence in the Milky Way and Magellanic Clouds, but why has one of them got a much bigger range of radio?
I don't know. Every massive stars people here.
Distance sensor for the Milky Way.
More than a factor of 10 range in radius, if you go back to our earlier discussion.
Before we go on, are there any correlations between the stellar radiuses determined from the early light curve and the stellar radiuses inferred from the plateau?
Inferred from what?
Plateau properties, if you were to attribute any of the changes in plateau properties to stellar radius.
Okay, so there have been some claims that there's some correlation between the rise and the plateau luminosity, but those have not held up in terms of statistical significance with larger samples, but of course they're very hard to measure. So the rate, I'm talking about the rate of the rise and the plateau luminosity. But there's one caveat I'm going to get to here, is about the early time light curves. So focusing on this one here, because it's fit better, there was one thing that is seen for this object, which has a very nice fit, so these are the residuals. So there's a little bit of excess right at the beginning. And so Kepler has a very red band pass, as opposed to shock breakout, which is supposed to peak in the UV, which is a little bit unfortunate. But if you take standard models for shock breakout, you have a transient which lasts for a couple hours at most, and that is dependent on the radius of the star. And if you take standard models for the shock breakout transient and take your fit parameters for that star, given the kinetic energy and radius, you get the green line for the prediction for the shock breakout transient in the Kepler bandpass. And there it goes through the data, and it removes the excess. So you were talking here a couple points, but otherwise those points are in fact outliers at a very suspicious time. The other one here, 2011A, does not show this excess related to the shock breakout transient. However, it shows an excess relative to the model that lasts for a couple days.
Just to say that you wouldn't expect the shock breakout in a smaller one, right? Because it would be dimmer and bluer, or at least bluer and shorter. So you probably
So everything scales like the radius of the star here, and so it should be for. So this is a red supergiant. This is a blue supergiant, to give you an idea. And so if it's a smaller star, it's somewhere in between the two. So yeah, it might not be detectable. I don't know. I wasn't involved in this. But the point I wanted to bring out here is, even though you can't detect a shock breakout, maybe you shouldn't expect to see it, because you have an excess in emission at early times relative to something that fits the rise in the rest of the light curve. And this excess in the first 5 days can be modeled by adding some very nearby CSM with an M dot that's of order 10 minus 4 solar masses per year. So that's two objects that have been seen, one of which is well fit by a standard rise time model, and one of which has an excess. And of course, there's more Kepler objects like this now, but they haven't been published yet. And so now I'm going to highlight just one, another single object study, even though I'm talking about samples, that's because UV observations are so rare. So this is one of our Pan-STARRS objects, where at late times you have a plateau. This is the Rainbow's DRIZ. You can fit the model with a standard model from Luc Desart, 15 or 18 solar mass red supergiant. At early times in the UV, you predict that you should have this kind of magenta light curve for that explosion model. And yet the data's up here. So based on just your parameters for the envelope cooling emission, this is above the light curve. The other natural source of light is you have a shock breakout transient. But our time scale here is 2 days, which is way too long for a shock breakout transient from the surface of a red supergiant. And so if you take a shock breakout through a wind model and add some CSM with an R to the minus 2 with M dot, 10 to minus 3 solar masses per year, this is not a precise number, you can extend the shock breakout time scale here and match those data points roughly.
So
in terms of the luminosity and time scale.
Perfectly plausible, but I'll provide another possible explanation next week.
Oh, good.
Is there any evidence of pre-supernova activity? Because this would be putting a bunch of stuff not
The object's too distant to have any hope of seeing outburst.
So especially with the UV and higher energy photons, this is where including shock heating is critical. And most of the codes that do light curves do not have, don't do red hydro. They have a homogeneous expansion. And so without the shock heating, you know, if you had material on top, and this is what Chevalier puts in the recipe for doing shock heating is, you know, a piece that we're missing in a lot of our light curve comparisons.
But not all.
Not all. But there, you know, I can count, you know.
Yeah, no, I understand.
What do you mean exactly?
By not one.
So if you can heat up the material again, because it's shocking against the material, so for two ends, we almost always put in, we want to do red hydro, where we actually, the shock adds energy back to the hydro, and you actually heat up through that. So shock heating is, you know, most of the codes that, you know,
taking something beyond the homologous expansion.
Yeah, so doing something other than homologous expansion.
And these models are nowhere near homologous expansion at breakout. Half of the energy is still internal energy, half is in kinetic energy.
Yeah, so a lot of the simple
things
and even for shock breakout, a lot of the simple assumptions we make, they're good for a first pass, but they're not good for actually getting numbers out of the light curves.
Yeah, so one last point about this I wanted to make was that we have limited observations and actual detections of other early type 2 supernovae that don't show this excess. And what's shown in these two panels here, the data points are the same in each panel. It's the light curve and different filters, and here's our UV excess. The solid lines represent two objects which were detected with Galax in the UV, in the near UV. And so these ragged lines, the data points connected for this. So one was the Supernova Legacy Survey object, which there were papers by Shawinski and Ghazari about modeling this as potential shock breakout transient.
Yeah, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say I trust the Shawinski data points more than the Ghazari ones, but that's okay. I just had to say that. You don't have to respond.
And it's recorded. Join me for me.
Go to the microphone. But the takeaway point here is that for objects that where you can kind of match the plateau more or less and everything, you get UV data points that do not include this couple day long excess emission. And so, in my mind at least, that point does point to the idea that it is some sort of mass loss related thing rather than something that's, you know, a natural consequence of a red supergiant that we're leaving out of our codes or something. That's something specific to this object.
Sorry, for this object, is there a progenitor radius estimate?
Yes, and I don't remember off the top of my head. I mean, just from the usual fits here, because this is a faint supernova.
So I'm still not quite following the logic of your conclusion on the other one. If it had not been, if it had just been by the object and not by any kind of circumstellar material, you would have expected to see a UV signature?
What I'm saying is these other objects, which have very similar optical light curves and have much lower UV emission at early times. Okay. So the UV emission is due to something we're leaving out of the code at early times, you'd expect them to also show
it.
Instead,
I see.
There's some variation. And there's no statistics here on frequency. Okay. Now I just want to make a few brief comments about stripped envelope supernovae. Once we get rid of all that pesky hydrogen, we get light curves that go up and they go down. No plateaus. So this is normalized to peak. This is not. And in the last 5 years, there's now been several attempts to put together large samples of supernovae that are stripped envelope, have lost their hydrogen envelopes. And so in order to interpret physically what's coming out of the light curves, we have to go back to our net diffusion models from 1980. And this is more easily physically interpretable here. That this is from actually a type 1a supernova paper, but the same physics applies for 1bs and 1cs, where you have some input energy from radioactive decay. You have some light curve. Initially, the input radiation can't diffuse outward, and so the luminosity is below the radioactive decay input. But as it expands, eventually the diffusion timescale becomes the same as the expansion timescale, and it peaks roughly at the peak luminosity is roughly the input of radioactive decay energy, so the luminosity is proportional to the height here. And you have some width here and some characteristic time scale. And actually, should say, this is a chart. Arnett originally wrote this down as tau goes like kappa to the 1/2, m ejecta to the 3/4 over kinetic energy to the 1/4. And so as long as kinetic energy goes like mv squared, where this velocity is some sort of mean or average velocity, then you get kappa m ejecta over some average velocity to the 1/2, which is how I've written it here because I'm an observer and this velocity is a measurable. Now, I'll come back to this in just a second, but then you look at this, you have a width, you can parameterize it in different ways, but you can measure a width from the light curve, you can measure a velocity from the spectrum, you can assume an opacity, and that gives you injecta mass. So very roughly speaking, just from looking at the light curve here, you can measure a nickel mass and an injecta mass and have a simple physical intuition for why you get the results you do. And this is a scaling that I've taken from a paper by Craig Wheeler, which inserts on the constants here. And in the parameterization of Arnett, this constant of proportionality is a well-defined number which you can just integrate in this called beta, and it's 13.8 for a dimensionless thing. And so you get some ejecta mass which scales like this. You can just measure some time scale, some velocity, assume a capacity to get ejecta mass. But there's a couple observational problems here. One is that nice curve I just showed you was a bolometric light curve. Typically, we have some light curve in certain specific filters, and we usually only have optical data. And so you have to make some correction. So one thing to do is integrate across the optical, call that a pseudo bolometric, and maybe apply some scaling factor. Here's a very well-observed object, 2008D, where we had early time UV and near-infrared. So we can look at, in blue, the UV contribution to bolometric, in red, the infrared, gold, the optical. So you can also take your optical, you can fit a black body and extrapolate and add those in to back that out your bolometric. Or you can apply various scaling factors based on a few handful of well-observed objects to figure out how to convert your optical luminosity to a bolometric. As always, extinction corrections are non-trivial and uncertain, but probably large, because these are potentially massive stars that might be behind a magnitude of extinction on average, so you probably want to include that. Alternatively, taking this from a theoretical point of view, it's easy to calculate this in your code. It's much harder to calculate a wavelength-dependent light curve. So depending on whether you're going from the observations or from the theory, there's a little bit of a mismatch. Problem two is, what do we use for the opacity? I just said, well, you assume an opacity. Okay, it's hydrogen poor. The opacity is not the standard 0.36. But you have to assume something. And it's not entirely clear what to assume. And different authors assume values that vary by, say, a factor of 2, which, if you go back to our scaling here, the mass of the ejecta is inversely proportional to the opacity.
Why is it so low?
Because it's not
non-ionized material.
Yep. And there's potentially other effects here. So there was a very interesting paper by Craig Wheeler that came out 2015 or 2016, can't remember. I think this is right. Where he took a few very well-observed objects, where there's kind of these Arnett law fits the early time light curve, and there are these late time observations that go all the way out in the radioactive decay tail. And he said, if you apply the standard fits the early time light curves, you imply something about the gamma ray trapping and what should happen on the radioactive decay tail, and these don't match up. And so there's a couple different ways to show that. This is his plot from his paper, which is a deposition timescale, which is estimated from the early time light curve and the actually observed late time light curve, and they don't match. And he said, well, one way to get around this is that the opacity is actually lower than people assumed. And he has some extended discussion about, well, you have some recombination effects, you have changing ionization levels, the opacity is typically assumed to be a constant in these objects. And of course, if the ionization level is changing over time, the opacity should change over time. But, you know, a factor of 2 in opacity becomes magically a factor of 2 in all the ejecta masses. Other concerns? What is this velocity? So the standard thing to do is say this is mean velocity is kind of a photospheric velocity near maximum light. And we measure, hopefully, an iron 2 line. It's relatively weak, and therefore we can measure the absorption velocity. But there might be factors of order unity to relate the thing we actually measure of a photospheric velocity to this kind of mean thing that people aren't very careful about.
See, I've just looked at a few observation results on velocities, and it seems like the uncertainties for the one these guys for the iron velocities are much bigger than I see for the uncertainties on the 2Ps. Is that am I just getting a wrong impression from having the
velocities? I'm not sure what you're thinking of. Certainly, the velocities tend to be a little bit higher here, which blends the lines, which does
maybe
tend
to
harder to measure. But that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Of course, non-spherical effects, which we know from the nebular spectra, these are not spherical. We made an assumption of spherical symmetry. And in particular, clumping and mixing of nickel outwards can change the diffusion timescale. If you mix a nickel outwards, it shortens the rise time because that energy can get out. But given all these caveats, you can just take some observed 1B, 1C light curves. So Maria's paper was the first one to look at a sample in VNR. Just look at the thick blue and red lines. The blue and red are 1Bs and 1Cs, and this is a measure of the time scale of the light curve. And they're basically completely overlapping distributions. So the 1Bs have helium, the 1Cs don't. Same time scales. Okay, if you look a little bit more closely, this is a paper from Prentice et al., from Colin Mazzali's student, where they broke a bunch of light curves down, and they measured sort of a rise time scale and a decay time scale, and there is some statistically difference between the 1Bs having slightly longer rise time, but the overall width is more or less the same between 1Bs and 1Cs. And similarly, the peaks. So These are distributions. Again, look at the solid lines, blue and red, blue and red. They're completely overlapping to within our ability to measure it. And so normal 1BCs, 1Bs and 1Cs, the helium-rich and the helium-poor supernovae completely overlap in light curve timescales and luminosities. And so on any sort of our net model, this means that the ejecta properties are therefore overlapping. So these are the observed data where now reds are 1Cs and blues are 1Bs, but this is the observed sort of time scale versus peak luminosity. And overlaid here is a grid of nickel masses versus essentially ejecta masses. And so no matter what your choice for the opacity is, how you measure the photospheric velocity, they all overlap in the observables, so they're all going to overlap in the fundamental parameters. The one difference are the 1C broad lines. So the broad line 1Cs are of interest because they're the ones that have been associated with gamma ray burst. Not all of them host gamma ray bursts, of course. But statistically speaking, the luminosity peak tends to be about half a dex higher. Now, this depends very sensitively on which sample you look at, because these are typically not selected in the same ways as the regular 1Cs and 1Bs because they're rarer objects. But this implies a corresponding sort of factor of 2 in nickel masses.
Can you remind us how much rarer they are?
Not the top of my head.
Something like 10%.
Yeah, so since there's some indication that it's a metallicity dependent effect, it depends on which sample you look at as well. And so I've shown from, this is from Prentice, but there's a couple other recent surveys trying to do the same thing where they apply consistent modeling methods to more or less overlapping objects or not. Just look here, red and blue are 1Bs and 1Cs, and they overlap in nickel mass, ejecta masses, and kinetic energy estimation. The 1C broad lines, it depends on which sample you look at, exactly how different they are. And so what I wanted to say about this was, okay, if you break this down, 1Bs, 1Cs, 1C broad lines. So I took these numbers from Tadia because they had the nicely listed in the conclusion section when I was looking at it last night. But if you compare these numbers and you look at, say, different people doing different fitting, so the Drought et al. Paper used a factor of 2 different opacity, which goes as a factor of 2 in the mass. But again, these broad trends all hold. One thing is that the nickel masses here in this paper are a little higher than the other papers. So this is from the Prentice that I just quoted. Again, tenths of the solar mass, so higher than a typical type 2. But pretty much the same between 1Bs and 1Cs, given the wide dispersion in all these properties. So my summary for the stripped envelopes is there's very little distinguished 1Bs from 1Cs. The ejecta masses are low. Three, five solar masses.
Well, solar masses of helium material is not too low.
Well, the Drought et al. Have really low.
2.7.
So it's two to five, depending on your model.
And remember that if Craig Wheeler is right and the opacity needs to be lowered, all these need to be lowered as well by that factor.
And then all the energies go up, right?
Then they go.
Yes.
All the helium, which is ejected, but yes. Solar masses, so it's okay.
Yeah, so 2 is okay.
Even
5, 3 to 5 is
not.
I
don't
care
how
worried
it's more. Yeah, so, but see everything about opacities, because factors of 2, as we've discussing, are important here.
Are there no 1B broad lines?
That's an interesting question. There are claims of detections of helium in 1C broad lines. So I would say that there's some evidence that the 1C broad lines, some of them have some helium.
Harder to want to say broad? Is that part of the issue?
So I think in the analysis by Yuchen Liu and Mario Mojas, they found that there was completely distinct. I think it's an open question, though. How much can you hide just, not in radio transfer terms, but in terms of looking at the spectrum, because the lines are just all blended together, right?
So you, just to make sure I understood, if you lower the opacity, it's inversely, the ejected mass is inverse, is it right?
Yeah.
So you increase the mass, yeah. Okay, I just wanted to make sure I thought you had said something different later, and I was going, that doesn't make sense.
Yep.
If this will make sense.
Okay. And when we say ejector mass, do you really mean ejector mass? I'd ask because there's some, we have eliminated any stuff that's
falling back.
Falling back.
Because what matters is the diffusion time scale, and so it needs to be a stuff
on the outside. I think that might be part of Natasha's issue.
But anyway, this is what I've...
What about 2Bs? Do 2Bs exist?
Yes, and they are...
Do 2Bs exist? Are they any different, do you think? They sort of blend into this one?
Boom. So here are the 2Bs in the printed sample. They blend in completely with the 1Bs, and even on the peak luminosities, it's all completely overlapping. So the boundary is a little bit fuzzy.
It's just basically you can see a bit of hydrogen in the spectra, but it's not, it seems to be doing much in terms of the overall properties.
Yes. So the people's standards for calling things 1Bs versus 2Bs empirically vary. So that is a concern, that how much hydrogen do you need to have?
Follow with Elaine here earlier in this program arguing that there basically there weren't any 1Bs anymore.
Well.
There's always a trace of hydrogen.
Yes.
Our kind of arbitrary where you set that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
So you said, so Craig Wheeler identified a mismatch between the early time and late time light curves. And then at some point, Leahy said, if he's right, then the opacities have to change. Presumably, he can be right and we change the late time light curve rather than the...
Oh, yeah. I meant if his interpretation is correct, that you have to deal with the opacities because...
So what changes if we change the late time?
I'm not sure.
What about the slope of the late time light curve for 1Bs and 1Cs? You discussed a little bit about the other case, the 2P case.
I don't know off the top of my head of, it's always faster than the cobalt decay.
Yeah.
So it's not fully trapping the cobalt.
There would be some nickel left around still a little bit, but something is, it seemed like the disparity between the expected cobalt decay and the tail on these guys was even greater than I was seeing in the 2P cases.
Yes.
That was supposed to be the gamma there, that's the...
So this is first of all, it's schematic and it's for 1A, and so this gamma must have something folded into it about, it shouldn't be right below, it should be above, right? Yes, because it's not fully trapped. So this gamma must include some trapping factor or something.
It's weird.
Yeah.
There's some going on.
But this is what I prepared, and the summary is basically, these are the simplest objects to model, and I hope I've convinced you that you should not have great confidence in the absolute numeric values that come out of any sort of fit to the data. Perhaps relative statements are still okay within a given set of assumptions, but I thought I would show this because we all want to work on exotic weird things, and it's not clear that we understand basic ones.
So going back to the possibility of circumstellar interaction as the source of energy in type 2Ps, type 2Ls that makes them not Ps. So I'm just trying to understand how you arrange that exactly while also being able to see the very early light, because that material presumably has to be optically thick to affect the affect the light curve. I mean, at least once it's ionized, it has to be optically thick to electron scattering to affect the light curve like that. And then also, wouldn't that produce prodigious X-ray and be obvious maybe in the early radio emission?
I think those are both excellent questions, and you certainly run into problems if this outer radius is too large. I don't know how much you can get away with at early times.
Yeah, I mean, you use that to explain some of so we have some supernova that are X-ray bright, and you say, I'm going to put some interaction in it, and then I can either get UV or X-ray brighter for longer because of the interaction.
But then that should correlate really well with whether it was a 2L or a 2P.
Yeah, so I would be surprised if this is a factor you have to include, but I'd be surprised if you can explain the whole population by that.
I guess the question is whether, an extra, whatever that is, 10 to the 48 ergs, half of that were coming out in x-rays, whether that would be observable over that time.
I'm still not quite following what you're saying, because I don't see why that unshocked circumcellular medium has to be optically. I can see it come up.
That's the first question.
That's your first question. And if it's really very, very low density, it's not optically thick until it gets hit. But once it gets hit, it obviously ionizes and it gets optically thick. And then, so it's not you're creating new energy, it's more it's just delaying the escape of the what was in there. And slowing down that initial, instead of having that initial flash come up really down really fast, that stuff gets trapped inside. It has to work its way out.
Well, no, I think you're releasing kinetic energy.
Yeah, you are. But it's
usually the bigger effect.
But it's not because, but the things are not trapped in behind some optically thick CSM.
Yeah, I think they probably did the calculation. You can see if they're getting the breakout anyway, because it's cold enough that it's not optically thick until it hits it. So you can see breakout, and then it hits. And
it's not flash ionized by the breakout. Or is it? I don't know. It's...
Yeah, I think that is a concern. Why isn't it?
I doubt if that's getting modeled. I'd like back to Chris's point. If that's getting modeled.
Yeah, and the question is, the hard part with these simulations is we all make approximations, and then the question is, I was responding to an email today, Barnett, yesterday, is what physics are we missing? And we're coming up, we have like 10 ideas of physics that we know we're missing.
Yep.
And which one will explain this feature that we're not getting right? The problem is to get all the physics in is hard, so if
this is this is super hard squared with this problem.
Yeah. Well, this is why I wanted to take your things like your rotation and say, okay, I'm gonna not worry about that and have my free parameters be, because rotation affects things like mass loss, and I want you to give me just mass loss, radius, mass,
sure.
Sure. But in the end, there's a lot of stuff that we're still ways from understanding supernova like hers. And that's what you said, but the point is,
the alternative philosophy to yours, which is to paraphrase, take a huge sample and try to explain averages.
And that's part of our distributions.
Distributions, of course, averages and distributions. The other side of it says, okay, now all of a sudden we're getting vastly superior observations than we ever had in the past. Take a small handful of the current batch that have super good observations on them and try to really understand in detail what might produce that particular case. That's sort of the direction that I'm coming from.
But how widely are you going to allow yourself to explore? Because,
I worry about overfitting.
Of course. I would worry about it, sure. The point is, it's not clear you can generalize from that one fit to anything else other than that one fit, but it might help answer some of Chris's questions about what are we leaving out? What do we have to have in the physics to at least have an existence of a model that kind of matches something?
So my only concern with when you fit one model is...
There's going to be 10 fits to the one set of
options. So 2010 JL, we did a fit because we were focusing on the new star observations. And thinking, okay, we have to do something to make all these x-rays, blah, blah, blah. So we ended up having this, it's either a parent stable supernova or a hypernova, we push that, so we went extreme. And Luke Desart had a fit that was much more sane, And
I'm not saying it's going to be unique, the fits are not going to be unique.
But the issue is we got two fits, they both fit the data.
Yeah. That says, now figure out how you can disambiguate.
How do you find
all the progenitor observation? Look at things where you see a progenitor. Because then you have a much stronger constraint about what you're actually doing. So 2011H and 93J and what are the other ones?
I think we have to do both. I think we've been lax, and I'm glad you showed a lot of studies where people are now doing it. You have this population, can you explain trends? Because I think there's a lot you can learn from, can you explain just basic trends in the data? So I mean, I think both approaches, there's just a tendency to explain, go from one system to the next.
And it's worse than that, because you start with 87A and 93J, which are not represented in the population. So once you've tweaked that model, how does it apply?
The two closest examples are the two.
Well, I mean, and then the other one you can do from the remnant site is CASA, and it's also a freak, so they're all freaks. Maybe they're all.
Well, this comes back to the thing about invoking binaries. I mean, binaries are there whether we invoke them or not, right? So the single star grids are just wrong, right? That's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, the hope with the type 2Ps is that it's a red supergiant, has a massive hydrogen envelope that has to have the least amount of binary interactions history. So
there's probably a lot of mass gainers in there rather than mass losers, right?
There could be some weirdos hidden in there, of course. So
that's the question. Are the binaries the weirdos or the normal ones? That's the question.
That's a different question than what happens when you get a core collapse. How you get there is one question. What happens after you do that is another.
It's purely a population scale thing.
Yes.
When you're looking at populations.
So wait, what do you think for 2Ps, what do you think the binary interaction is?
So I think a significant fraction of them will be mass gainers, right? They can't be mass losers, but some of them will have gained mass. The question is
how. Just from a stable mass transfer? Is that the piece of?
That doesn't mean I'm saying it's definitely important for interpreting the population, but I'm saying the assumption that it might be important for interpreting the population is not a weird one. It should be a reasonable statement.
You know, if you're just adding hydrogen mass to it, it's not like I trust Bill's model for what's the hydrogen versus helium core mass of a progenitor anyhow. So I mean, for me, it's doing Likers, that's just, it's just a, you know, it's not affecting my free parameters that I already allowed myself.
So why do you say they're not mass gainers?
Sorry?
Why do you say they're not mass? I'm sorry, not mass losers.
Because if they lose too much mass, they won't be 2Ps anymore. I mean, I still, so independent of whether I think binaries are important, this narrow range of plateau lengths is interesting, right? And maybe you can construct something such that if they lose so much mass, they drop off the small end. But I'm not saying I do that. I'm just saying the natural way to have lots of hydrogen left is to be a mass gainer, in other words. Assuming most of your mass is starting to play.
There
can be a mass. I mean, like you said before, I don't quite agree with the statement. You can do anything with binaries, but it's coming off.
If they're a mass gainer, doesn't there have to be a bigger star nearby that could record our inspiration?
Yeah, it's
okay. Oh, I see. So they did gain mass, and now they're okay.
Sorry,
that was
meant to be a short point.
Okay. So meet again tomorrow. And now we're going to hear about modeling or something tomorrow.
Something.